the Redskins. Hail victory! Praise on the warpath. Fight for all we see.
Green driven back to midfield on the far side. He's got the ball up to the 45, far side 40. A seam to the 35, balls a man to the 30. Breaks it to the near side 25. Watch out to the 20, near side 10. He's gone. Touchdown, Washington Redskins.
This is Burgundy and Gold Flashback. Now, here's Mike Richmond.
You are listening to Burgundy and Gold Flashback, where the tradition of a storied NFL franchise, the Washington Redskins, stays alive. I'm Mike Richmond, author of the Redskins Encyclopedia and the Washington Redskins Football Vault. My website is redskinshistorian.com. That's redskinshistorian.com. With Dallas on the schedule in Sunday's season finale, I thought it would be appropriate to have this man on. That's because he made one of the most memorable plays in the history of the Redskins-Cowboys rivalry. On the phone with me now, from a Salt Lake City suburb, it's former Redskins defensive end Jason Buck. Hey Jason, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, you're welcome, Mike. I love the opportunity.
Yeah, great to have you on, and I know we've run into each other at a few alumni events, and I said, hey, I'm going to give you a call at some point, and I really want you to come on the show, so I appreciate you doing it. So what are you up to these days? I read something where you're doing public speaking.
Yeah, I do public speaking. I'm working on a book, my life story, and hopefully have that out in the next year or so. Quite a project. And then I, you know, work on building some small companies and, you know, incubate them and grow them. And so I've got a real entrepreneurial side to me and stay really busy in the thick of things.
Now, I know you had political aspirations at one point. You sought the Republican nomination for a U.S. congressional seat from Utah in 2012.
Yeah. Yep. I ran for that, did well, you know, for a first time in. A guy that won it, Chris Stewart, a great guy, but he had been in politics for about 30 years, and it's to be honest, it's just really hard to beat those people in the political establishment that are in it for so long. But, you know, I just felt that urge to show my children that, you know, their father would stand for their country and fight for what he believes in and try to do what's good. And it was a great experience.
Do you aspire to someday continue in politics?
No, not really. I mean, I'll never say never. But I'll tell you, it's truly out of service. There's so much pain involved. I mean, it's really a cruel business. And I'm just a big-hearted guy and by nature. And I love my friends and love family. And it's, like I said, it's real cruel. But to serve my country and to serve my family, I would do it again. But maybe down the road in a few years.
Mm-hmm. So when Redskins fans hear the name Jason Buck, many remember one play, and actually it's known as The Play. On December 13th, 1992, at RFK Stadium, Cowboys were leading the Redskins 17-13 with 3 minutes left, and Cowboys quarterback Troy Aikman drops back to pass in his end zone, and then all of a sudden there was chaos. So why don't you take us through that play?
Oh, gosh. It's just like it was yesterday. You know, it was crunch time, and we had to have this game to get in the playoffs. Of course, it was Dallas on Sunday night, and everything had built up to this. I mean, you have John Madden doing the game, and, you know, the excitement of it. You know, here you are fighting your whole life to play in the NFL, and you're in the moment. You're on the field, and you're in the huddle. And I turned to Charles Mann in the huddle and said, Charles, I'm going to sack Aikman. I'm going to knock the ball out. You pick up the ball for a touchdown. And you know, I just felt it right there at that moment. I knew I was going to make this play. And they actually shifted me down to nose guard. I stemmed down to nose guard, which is the toughest spot to get the sack from because they usually double-team you and just pinball you down in there. And surprisingly, dropped back to pass. And they left me one-on-one with Stepnoski. And I got him turned and drove him back into Aikman, took them both down really to the ground at the same time, and the ball came out, and it was just euphoria. I mean, I can't tell you the feeling that came over me when that ball came out and we picked it up for the touchdown. I mean, I danced from one end of the end zone to the other. I mean, my war dance. I was going crazy. and the emotions that run through you and the exhilaration is just something you'll never forget.
Right. Well, I know there was a big pileup when that ball came out, and it was on the ground in the end zone, and the Redskins safety Danny Copeland came up with it for the TD, and that gave the Redskins a 2017 lead, and you guys held on to win. You had your hand flat on that ball, though, right? Aikman was he was trying to push forward with the pass. Is that correct? But you pulled back.
Yeah, they reviewed that multiple times, and he went to throw, and Darryl Green jumped the route, and he pulled back. And so when he pulled back, you know, then I knocked the ball out. Again, had my hand on the ball, knocked it out, and, you know, it was ruled a fumble, and it was in the replays. And but it was because Darryl jumped that route, and it made him pull back, and then I got the sack and knocked the ball loose.
Yeah, like I said, that was one of the greatest plays in history of the rivalry, and it's like vivid in the minds of so many Redskins fans. And
I'll tell you, just I have people talk to me about it all the time still, and I had somebody approach me last year here in Utah that had actually moved here from Virginia, and they were in the second up on the second level in RFK. They'd had lifetime tickets, and they said they were there for that play, and you know how the lower decks would just shake. Right? And you just literally stand on the field and look underneath the chairs and you could see the stadium just shaking.
Mm-hmm.
And in RFK, and he said for the first time in the history of the game, at least when he had been there, the upper decks were shaking. And he thought they were coming down when I made that play. You could even hear yourself, right? I mean, RFK had just gone crazy and erupted. It was just such an awesome event in my life to be able to be there, play for the Redskins, make a play like that, and be a part of Joe Gibbs' history in a very special time in Redskin history.
Well, that win improved the Redskins to 9-5, and then you guys went on to make the playoffs, and you beat the Vikings in the first round that year. And that season was also the last in the Joe Gibbs one era. Which leads me to ask you about the previous year, 1991. You guys won the Super Bowl 26. You beat Buffalo and finished 14-2 in the regular season, and then just romped through the playoffs and just destroyed the Bills in Super Bowl 26. So, tell me about that year, though. In terms of the defense, the Redskins' capital defense was really good. You had three shutouts that year, and you allowed only 224 points, which was second lowest in the league, and I don't think the defense gets enough credit on that team. When that team is spoken of, it you hear a lot about the Hogs and Mark Rippon and their accomplishments. But tell me about the defense on that squad.
Oh, gosh. You know, the Redskins were just operating on all cylinders. And, you know, the offense deserved all the publicity it got. Rippon had a great year. The Hogs were playing great. Everybody was just on fire. I mean, everybody was, all the way across the team. We had just such special unity and brotherhood in the locker room and love of each other and great leadership on the team. I mean, it all just came together perfectly, and we stayed healthy. But the defense was just fantastic. And to come in from the Bengals and have that opportunity to play for the Redskins and come in that year and contribute, you know, I got to sack Jim Kelly in that Super Bowl and, you know, have another fantastic play in front of my wife and kids and family, and it was such a great experience. And our defense, I mean, Wilbur Marshall and, you know, our D-line and Charles Mann and Darryl Green and, you know, on, and every single player on that team just was playing so well that year. And of course, you know, the offense, when it plays that well and runs the ball so well and controls the clock, makes your defense even better. So, you know, that helped. But, you know, we are just untouchable. I mean, that team deserves to be one of the greatest, you know, rated teams of NFL history. Definitely does.
Well, I personally believe that team was the greatest of the Joe Gibbs one era, because you went on to win the Super Bowl. The 1983 team also finished 14-2, but did not win the Super Bowl 18 against the Raiders. But you guys just... you were like clicking on all cylinders, both the offense and defense on that squad. There was just such a chemistry.
There was. And, you know, you owe that to Joe Gibbs. I mean, I'll tell you a special story. I came in from the Bengals, and it was just, Dick LeBeau was a great guy, and I had great teammates, and we went to Super Bowl 23 together. But the team was just overall, there was close groups on the team, but as an entire team, we weren't as close as we were, that Super Bowl team I was with the Redskins. And I was under a lot of, just harsh treatment and adversity there at Cincinnati. And I came in to Washington, D.C., and Joe Gibbs brought me in his office when he picked me up and sat me down one-on-one and talked to me and said, Jason, he goes, I know what kind of a person and what kind of a man you are and the kind of people you come from and your family and your farming background and your work ethic. And he goes, Jason, I believe strongly in character first, athlete second, and I'll always take a man with character like you and win championships. And as long as I'm here, you'll be playing football. You're going to have a 12 to 14 year career with me. And I about cried. Honestly, I sat there and looked at him and thought, I will die for this man. And that's what he did. He just inspired you and demanded the grit best out of you. And he recruited character overall. I mean, he might've had one or two projects that he worked on, but really that team is so special and the way Joe recruited it. And we had that reunion down at his place in North Carolina a couple of years ago. And it's just for the guys, all of his guys from, his Redskin years from, the early 80s to 92. And we were all like a bunch of brothers and just talking at the mic and crying and laughing and hugging and looked like a bunch of little kids out there, boys that just got together and with their best friends. And you really owe that to Joe Gibbs' philosophy. And that special magic that you just can't explain was created because of that, character first, athlete second, work ethic, workhorses. And, man, we just came together for one of the greatest teams in NFL history.
Well, that really sounds like typical Joe Gibbs and what I've heard from so many players over the years, that he focused so much on character and he wanted guys who were going to give it their all and be great team players. And in terms of that reunion down at, that was at Joe Gibbs Racing, right, in Charlotte?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I've spoken to a number of players about that, and they said it was just so much fun getting together with guys they had, who were their teammates and reminiscing and sharing anecdotes and stories and things like that. So I know you had a blast down there.
It was very special. It was very special. We were really close. And, because they're Joe Gibbs guys, we commented on when we were talking to each other, the vast majority of those players have gone on to be successful in the private sector and their personal lives and still look healthy and, raised their families and done good. And I would venture to say that a much higher percentage of Joe's players in their post-careers have had success with their families and their careers, more so than other teams.
Now, I mentioned earlier that I've seen you at a number of Redskins alumni events, and you told me in a previous conversation that you love coming back to this area, coming back to Northern Virginia, so I hope you're able to make it back here again in the near future for Redskins gatherings. I really hope to see you there.
Absolutely. I do not miss them and hate to miss them. And my wife, Roxy, and I talk about how much we miss Northern Virginia and that, entire Washington, D.C. area, how much we just love the people, the area, the community, our experience with the Redskins. And I'm so thankful that, Snyder and the Redskin organization and Bruce Allen have pushed this and brought us back together, because we really miss Northern Virginia and that area. We actually still talk about moving back and being there, because it was just such fond memories.
Well, that's great stuff, Jason. We need to go to break. When we come back, I want to talk to you about your childhood, your celebrated college career, and many other things. Here's This Week in Redskins History.
Hey, it's Mike Richmond, the official Redskins historian and author of the Washington Redskins Football Vault and the Redskins Encyclopedia. From the pages of my books comes This Week in Redskins History. On December 26, 1999, the 8-6 Redskins needed a win over 4-10 San Francisco to capture their first NFC East title since 1991. The Skins nevertheless trailed 20-10 early in the fourth quarter, but they battled back. Brett Conway's field goal and quarterback Brad Johnson's one-yard TD sneak tied the game at 20. In overtime, the Redskins drove 78 yards in four plays for the winning score. From the 49ers 33, Johnson threw a short pass to fullback Larry Centers, who ran untouched into the end zone. Johnson passed for team records of 471 yards and 32 completions that day, and Coach Norv Turner received the game ball. For more on Redskins history, check out my website at redskinshistorian.com. That's redskinshistorian.com. I'm Mike Richmond for This Week in Redskins History.
Welcome back to Burgundy and Gold Flashback. I'm Redskins historian Mike Richmond, back with former Redskins defensive end Jason Buck. Jason, thanks again for coming on the show. Great to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I know you have a very, very special story to tell regarding your childhood. You were born in Washington State, I read, in a town called Moses Lake. And I read also from an early age, you knew that you were destined to play professional football.
Yeah, 4 or 5 years old. I mean, old people will talk about, I would walk around church and the community and tell everybody in the world I was going to play pro football. And it's really unique. My two favorite teams back at that time were the Minnesota Vikings, and I was a real dreamer. And, you know, my family had a lot of Scandinavian, and I thought I was a Viking. So I was like, and my mom would always talk about our American Indian heritage in her family. And so I was a Viking fan and a Redskin fan from the time I was like 4 years old. And I ended up playing for the Redskins. So go figure that and having those experiences. But you know, grew up in a little farming family and moved around the United States from Washington to Michigan, then back to Idaho farming potatoes, and just real poor. We lost everything in Michigan and our farm and with the crop failure, and went back to Idaho and actually lived under a truck for a while and was homeless and showered, you know, in the watering or bathed in the watering trough where the cattle drank and just had nothing. And, you know, spent a lot of our life, you know, just struggling and hardship and, you know, some tragic death and even divorce in our family eventually and just fought and never gave up. I mean, I went to a little high school with 25 students in graduating class and there on the border of Idaho and actually had moonshine stills. It was like Dukes of Hazzard. It really was. And a little bit of Deliverance. And I was just here. I'm this kid in high school, 25 graduating class, telling everybody I'm going to play in the NFL someday. And
what was
had to
their
walk on.
What was their reaction when you would say that?
Oh, gosh. I'd just be scoffed at and laughed at. And I was always fighting, you know, just constantly at school because I'd come home from school and I'd have tobacco spit down the back of my coat from the guy spitting on me from behind. And I was just always despised and because I set goals, and if they asked, I'd stand for it, and I'd stand for my principles. And, you know, if they ridiculed my family because how poor we were, I'd fight and spend a lot of time in the principal's office and go to practice. And there'd be, you know, the old days, they didn't stop hazing, right? And every day I'd show up in the locker room, they'd have different pranks, try to drag me out in the field naked or, you know, snap me his towels and urinating on my clothes and my locker. And I really went through a lot. Cool. But I always went back and fought for what I believed in and my dreams and eventually walked on at college with no scholarship.
Let me just ask you, what does being homeless teach someone about adversity and survival in life?
You know, I never looked down on myself and I never looked down on my family through our struggles. As long as my family just was together, I was okay. I mean, we literally sat in the dirt by a fire at night and, you know, we'd set Campbell's soup cans in the fire and heat them up that way and eat right out of a can of soup, you know, Campbell's soup can. And I was okay. I thought, you know what? I'm just like a John Wayne movie or Swiss Family Robinson. I'm going to, you know, go out there and conquer the world. And I never for a second felt sorry for myself. And I guess that was the key. I always took personal accountability and knew I was going to change my life and change my destiny. I wasn't going to wait for somebody else to do it or wallow in self-pity. I took that responsibility and always dreamed and never let go of my dreams. And, you know, those examples of heroes that I had, even though I was homeless and sleeping under a truck. And no matter what we went through, I knew I would make my life better and held on to that every day, but I worked for it.
If only more people would adopt those beliefs in life and not be so dependent on other people and strive to achieve on their own. What you're saying, such a noble belief on your part and the way you approached life that you must be commended for it.
Well, thank you. You just have to make that choice that you're not going to be a victim. When you're intelligent enough to realize, hey, things are bad. They're really bad. You know, my mom suffered from depression and anxiety and had a lot of issues. And, you know, we didn't get taken care of that well at times. I mean, I always made a joke that we were kind of like the wolf children, you know, raising ourselves. But my dad tried real hard and is a good man. And but out of the 8 children in my family that, you know, made it to adulthood, only 2 of us graduated from high school. I mean, that's just how tough it was. And, but I chose not to be a victim. I said, when you're smart enough to eventually, when you have the ability to realize I'm in a bad situation, or my parents are talking about divorce, or there's, you know, you've been beaten, or, you know, I got beat by a horse whip, you know, by my mom, and on, and you go through those things and you're like, I can change this. You stop being a victim and say, I'm going to take responsibility and I'm going to change my future and my life and I'm going to make things right. Instead of wallowing in self-pity and bitterness, and you make that choice. And I was able to hold on and go all the way from there to then being made fun of and ridiculed and spit upon, and, you know, to sacking Troy Aikman in the end zone on RFK and playing for Joe Gibbs, one of the best NFL coaches of all time, and to have a beautiful wife and raise 4 successful children, and I did change my life. I did change it.
That's such an inspiring story. Regarding college, were you recruited by several schools?
Well, I walked on at a junior college named Ricks Junior College. It's in Eastern Idaho, a private school. And, you know, really a world-class junior college at the time. It's now called BYU Idaho. But at the time, it was a junior college. And I walked on there. And actually had to quit the team because I didn't have enough money to go to school. Because they moved me from quarterback. I was a quarterback through high school. And they moved me to D-line. So I actually quit the team and went back and got a job in town at a grain mill, throwing grain sacks for 9-hour days. And I'd go down with the weights till 10 at night, every night at the college, knowing that I was going to play D-line. So I spent 2 years lifting weights while my sweetheart Roxy was still finishing high school. And when she graduated, we got married and went back to Ricks, and they gave me a scholarship that year, a partial scholarship. And I made All-American my first year at Ricks Junior College. And then my second year, I was National Junior College Defensive Player of the Year. I set a national record of quarterback sacks with 25. And I was the number one recruited player in the nation in junior college football. So I went from walking on from a seed mill that I was getting offers to Alabama, Ohio State, Texas, all over the United States. I was considered the number one recruited JC player in the nation that year.
And you chose BYU?
Chose BYU. It was close to home. Just in the last second, I actually turned them down and was committed to Texas at the time. And, you know, my wife and I just decided, you know, this last night, we'll just pray about it. And it was such an important decision to us. And BYU just won the national championship that year in 84, or else they probably wouldn't have gotten me. I mean, I was definitely, I mean, honestly, they were like 4th on my list. I was going Texas, Ohio State, Alabama, you know, Arizona, a bunch of other schools. And in fact, I went, you know what, let's stay close to home, you know, representing my people in my area, in and out in the area. I said, I want to go out there and prove. Barry Switzer was just tearing down BYU and saying they're no good. And I was always been the underdog all my life, right? So I said, you know what? I'm going to go to BYU and prove that an Idaho farm kid can be as good as any nation. And just had that attitude, stay close to my family. And so BYU went there, and it all turned out. I mean, gosh.
You're in their Hall of Fame now, right?
Yeah, they haven't retired my jersey. I haven't finished my bachelor's degree, so I'm in trouble. But as soon as I finish my bachelor's degree, they finalize all that, you know, with not being there, Steve Young and Jim McMahon. And I'm the only consensus defensive All-American in the history of BYU.
That's amazing.
So, yeah, I win. Here I am, my second year. And BYU is not known for Ryman back then at all. And I win the Outland Trophy. I mean, the first time it had been given to a player west of the Rocky Mountains since Ron Yeary in '67 and at USC. And, you know, when they came to me out on that field and told me I'd won the Outland Trophy for the best down line in the United States, I just cried. You know, thought of my older brother that had died, and we were so close, and my family and our parents and our homelessness and every bale of hay I'd bucked and every pipe I'd lifted. You know, you just, to be named the best lineman in the United States was a dream come true.
And you were drafted in the first round in 1987, weren't you, the number 17 overall pick by the Bengals?
Yeah. Yep, a 17th player picked overall. I just, oh, other, I mean, it was just fantastic. Other than I went to the Bengals. It was just, I just can't tell you, you know, I don't like speaking negatively, but because I have so many, Cincinnati's a wonderful football town with wonderful people, but the organization doesn't hold a candle to the Redskins. It just doesn't. And it was just really bizarre. I went in, and my first day there, you know, the equipment manager called me a bunch of dirty names and threw the shoes at me, and I told him the helmet didn't fit, and he said he didn't care, get the hell out of my room. And I played my whole rookie year with my, I couldn't get my helmet to fit right, and or my shoulder pads, and the equipment manager wouldn't talk to me and fix my equipment, and the D-line coach would just throw me a sheet of paper and say, "Buck, no at you, a-hole," and blah, 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 blank, 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 blank. And I'm like, why did you guys draft me? I mean, I just got abused every day. And Dick LeBeau was awesome, but he wasn't my line coach. You know, he was the D coordinator who really liked me and brought me in, but it was like I was resented by everybody else. So it was a tough situation. I ended up starting my second year there after the strike year. The strike year was when I was drafted, and that was kind of just a tough year overall. And missed half the season with the strike, right, just about. And so my second year was really my rookie year, and I ended up starting. And I started and had a great year with them and started in Super Bowl 23. And, I mean, they called, you know, from Brigham Young University, Jason Buck, number 9. I mean, that was just, you run out on the field. That was a fantastic time of my life.
You came so close to beating the 49ers in Super Bowl 23. If it was Joe Montana led that 92-yard drive at the end of the game, capped by his winning pass to John Taylor. That ending must have been heartbreaking for you guys.
Oh, just broke our hearts. There's an NFL film called The Lost Rings. And if you look on that, it shows, you know, the final photo of the game. It shows me throughout the film on the NFL films, but the final pictures of me, and they bronzed it like on the film, and just broke, you know, just shows my face. It just encapsulated the game for everybody. I was just brokenhearted. We played so hard, and we had a magical year. I mean, we had a really good team with a lot of great guys.
Your years with the Bengals were actually more accomplished statistically than with the Redskins. You had a number of seasons with the Bengals. You had like six sacks in two of those years, and including the 88 season when you guys went to the Super Bowl. And then you were acquired by the Redskins prior to the 91 season. Was that through Plan B, the Plan B free agency?
Yeah. What happened is they picked me up. I started two seasons. So the Super Bowl season started, ended up with six sacks, and like then three sacks in the postseason. You know, I was getting sacks in every game in the season, so I ended up like 9 overall. And then I got 6 my next year. I missed 4 games that next year with a blown elbow. It dislocated against the Bears. So in 12 games, I had another 6 sacks. And then the fourth year, the new coach was starting to move me out, so they didn't give me much playing time my fourth year. And so we went into the camp my fifth season. I knew I was gone. You know, you can just smell it. And it didn't matter. I'd grade out 97% in the game, and I'd still be on the bench the next week. I mean, I was just not favored. I was just going to camp in fifth season, and led the team in sacks in camp, and second on the team in tackles in camp. I mean, just doing great. And they still held me and cut me. And so luckily, fortunately, 6 weeks later, I got picked up by the Redskins. So that's what happened. I got released, and then the Redskins picked me up week 6, and it was just magic. And, yeah, they used me as, you know, I was their journeyman that year. I was their journeyman backup and wasn't starting. And you know, got to just come in and make big plays. We got the sack in the Super Bowl 26 and just loved it. And then in 92, you know, I started maybe about half the games, I guess, in 92. Eric Williams went down, and then I would come out for jumpy gethers. So I'd play first and second down, and then jumpy gethers would come in on nickel. So I didn't have as much pass rushing opportunities. But I ended up second on the D-line in sacks that year.
And then you played for Richie Pettibone his year in 93, and then you retired after
that? Pettibone. Yeah, yeah, it was just really weird. Because Joe had left, right? And half the game in pro football is once you're a veteran, if you got a coaching staff that loves you, you're done. You're in. Right? And that next year, I became their do-it-all guy. I mean, I was back at fullback on offense, short yardage and goal line. I did all special teams. I started all four positions on the D-line because I was the only D-lineman that could change my stances and move inside and outside. So I practiced for Charles all week when he was hurt and then started right tackle. Or I'd play the game, somebody get hurt in the game, and I'd move from right tackle, left end. And I started, Sam Huff had me as a player of the game Monday Night Football against Miami that last mid-season there. And then the next week I separated my shoulder against the Giants and finished the year on a shoulder. And the salary cap came in, right, at the same time?
Around that time, yeah.
And I didn't get a tryout the next year. I went from, it was really crazy. It was my coaching staff left, and they're all older guys. I haven't really got on any other staffs. And, you know, I went in defensive player of the game, you know, on Monday Night Football to not getting a tryout the next year. I felt like it was the best game of my life. And the salary cap came in, and they signed Leonard Marshall instead of me.
After the 93 season.
After the 93 season.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show, Jason. This has been a lot of fun. And I hope to have you on again on Burgundy and Gold Flashback. And also, many thanks to my audience for listening to BNG Flashback. And thanks to my producer, Mike Engel, for his work running the board. By the way, copies of my book, The Redskins Encyclopedia, are available by going to my website, redskinshistorian.com. I'll sign them, and they make for great holiday gifts. I'm Mike Richman. This is my final show of the 2014 season, but I hope to be back next year with more compelling interviews with those who wore the burgundy and gold. For now, hail to the Redskins.